So thanks for doing this, Adrian. Really appreciate it.
Not all done.
I've written a shitload of questions.
That's all done, man.
Sadly for you. And also, I've become slightly self-conscious with my questions after I interviewed, do you know, a cartoonist called R.O. Bleckman from New York? He does all that wobbly little style stuff that everybody in London used to rip off, like Grey Jolliffe and Alan Parker, and he was the originator of that.
Of course, yes. Grey Jolliffe was better than Parker, I think.
Yeah. Well, they both ripped off R.O. Bleckman, who's 94. He'd been in New York. He did things like that very famous Alka-Seltzer ad with the stomach talking to the man.
Well, I know the style. I know the style you mean.
He's 94. I did a podcast with him about 6 months ago. And then some of the questions I was asking, he was like, I've no idea. It was 60 years ago. What do you mean? So now and again, I realise that I'm asking you things from such a long time ago.
But, yes. There'll be a lot of that with me.
That's no worry. We can whip that out or keep it in if it's funny. But saying that, when we spoke before, you seem to have very good recall on things like the woman with the limping foot, which I went back and had a look at.
Funny. Yeah, she sort of walked funny. She's a little bit like a duck, I'd have to say. And I'd never seen her, you know, I just saw her sitting down on the couch. You know, I didn't actually see her entry into the room. You know, had I seen that, I think I'd have wondered whether to use her or not, you know. But she did look a little strange in the wellies.
It gives her a bit of character, dragging her foot along like that.
<That's right. Yes.
laughs> I thought, but I went back and I'd never noticed it before. So anyway, so let's start. Highgate School. So you've referenced that everywhere as being a nightmare. Why was that a nightmare?
Well, I just think the whole idea of segregating kids during puberty is such madness, is such lunacy. And of course, in that time, it was, you know, I guess in grammar schools and public schools that happened a lot. But, you know, about the only thing you really have to get to know about is women, I suppose. And the idea to sort of cut you off from that and have you walking around in incredible frustration for 5 or 6 years is silly, I think.
So is that what you meant when it's a nightmare, that there were no females there?
Well, I suppose it was part of it. I mean, such a ludicrous... I loathe the public school system. I mean, I only went to it because my father was a teacher in the elementary part of Highgate School, and so I got free tuition.
Right.
But, you know, the idea that 16-year-old boys could beat with a cane other younger kids or 16-year-olds or whatever... It's just madness. I mean, it's primeval. Can you imagine? I wonder how long that lasted.
I can't imagine, no. So were you beaten with a cane there?
I was beaten a couple of times, yes. By the headmaster, absolutely. Yeah, it was funny because he had a dog, you know. And I got, I think I got 5 or 6 strokes. And he put the dog outside in the corridor. And every time... he hit me with the cane, the dog would yap outside in the corridor. It was hilarious.
So I wondered whether it was a nightmare because most of those schools produce civil servants and very straight-laced people, and you'd be more creative. Were you creative as a child?
Well, the main thing that I really enjoyed at school was playing my trumpet. I played trumpet in the band, you know, in the brass band, right, which was like part of the cadet force. And I went on and played jazz in a jazz group for about 10 years after school. So it sort of started me off at that. That I would say would be the main benefit of Highgate School.
So were you into art or design, or were there anything, what was appealing to your eye at that young age?
Well, I like photography. I mean, a little bit later, I suppose, when I was 18 or 19, I would go to a repertory cinema, if you like it, called The Everyman, which was marvellous, actually, in Hampstead. And And I would just look forward to like the new Chabrol film or the new Truffaut film. I was just so excited by French cinema, really.
How would you have got such refined taste at that young age?
Well, I don't think it was refined particularly. I mean, I quite like the English New Wave as well. You know, I liked Tony Richardson and Carol Rice, Lindsay Anderson, these people. I mean, it was much more exciting, I think, in those days. I guess because stuff wasn't on television, and you had to eagerly await stuff.
Yeah.
To come into the theatre, into the movie theatre.
So, I read in one of these things, I think it may have been that documentary you sent, that you remember seeing in a Truffaut film, a girl against the wall, a massive expanse of a wall, and a yes. small girl that had a big impression. So,
well, I like the framing. It was very. It was a massive wall, brick wall. And as I remember it, she was, so most of what you saw was the wall and right down bottom right.
Yeah.
And it was a tracking shot. Very small was the girl, or I forgot whether it was a girl or a guy, but I just liked the arbitrary framing of it. I thought, and I remember seeing it and thinking, shit, I want to do that. You know, I want to put this girl bottom right and track along with her in that sort of eccentric framing.
Right.
I just thought it was marvellous.
And obviously this is before you were in commercials, directing, any of that, is it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah I was very passionate about it. I remember going to the Everyman and seeing it was one of Godard's films, the later ones, which was actually just awful. It was, which one it was? It was about, he had an obsession with Mao.
Right.
And he would put it in his movies, and he had long sort of dissertations, you know, on political dissertations in the film, and I became so enraged that I leapt to my feet and said, "Rubbish!"
Really, in the middle of the cinema?
Yeah, in the middle of the cinema. And so it was very English, you know, very English. And somebody at the back said, "Here, here," back at the theatre. You know, but that's having seen Breathless, which was a work of art. And it's still Breathless now is as good now as it was then with Belmondo, you know, marvellous movie.
So when you were watching these kind of films, were you plotting out some sort of route into shooting film yourself?
No, I think it was... Not really. I mean, it was a sort of Francophile thing. I mean, I just... All of the English really wanted to be French.
Right.
Because they were more interesting looking. They got the girls always. I mean, there was a place called Bournemouth by the sea, and the French would flock there to fuck the English girls.
Right.
And I remember going there and just being so impressed by this, their confidence. It was the French, that sort of confidence rather than that inhibited English thing. So I just love the whole, just the romantic aspect of the French way of life, of sitting in a cafe and reading Libération or something like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it was just wonderful if you're English and so far away and so impossibly exciting, really, you know, compared with our life.
When did you first go to... How old would you have been when you first went to France and experienced that?
I was 17. I hitchhiked with a friend. And I remember this beautiful French woman, quite a lot older than us, giving us a ride in a Panhard, P-A-N-H-A-R-D, a Panhard, which is a marvellous looking... It's a... Two-stroke cars, right. But lovely looking, sort of rounded front. And it was just so, and this woman sort of oozed sexuality, you know. It was just marvellous, marvellous. And I don't know, just so exciting, really.
It all sounds very exotic compared to what Britain would have been back then.
Well, it was, and then we also got picked up in a deux chevaux by a priest.
Yeah.
Who within 30 seconds had his hand on my thighs.
Oh, wow.
Can you imagine?
Not really, no.
That was the other side.
Yeah. So at the time, you would have been, was that when you were working at Peter Jones?
Just before, in fact. I guess I worked at, no, I didn't work at Peter Jones. I worked in an accountant's office that was opposite Peter Jones.
Oh, okay.
And the main, attraction of the accountant's office from the partners downwards was that we were opposite the dressing rooms, the ladies' dressing rooms in Peter Jones. So everybody had, literally everybody had binoculars, and they'd be ringing to each other and says, there's a nice one in number seven. And it was hilarious. And then one ghastly day, they changed the glass, you know, so that you couldn't look in.
And right. Harsh. So there's a pattern emerging as we're going through this.
Well, maybe. I mean, also the other thing I enjoyed doing there was I would practice my trumpet every lunch hour.
In the square?
No, in the accountant's office upstairs.
Right.
So I love that, you know, and I love playing with a band. I played with a band different bands for about 10 years. And I think that helped me later on with the music on films. I think the fact that I knew
it must have been. I've got some questions on that. So did the change of the glazing situation, Peter Jones, lead to you leaving your job to go to JWT?
Well, it wasn't the reason, Dave. It wasn't the reason. The reason was because I didn't know what to do. All I knew was I didn't want to be an accountant. And I spoke to a guy there, a very sweet man who played a guitar, actually. And he said, if you don't know what to do, you should go into advertising.
Right.
Because there you can do all sorts of different stuff. And I went into the mailing room at J. Walter Thompson, which was enormous fun. It was like this sort of rather seedy hotel where literally everybody was drunk after lunch.
Oh, wow.
But there was a lot of interesting eccentric characters there, like a Willie Landles, who I think later on was the editor of Harper's Bazaar. I mean, all sorts of interesting people there. It was an eccentric place. I loved it.
I know of several people there, like Peter Mead was there. Do you know Peter Mead of Abbott Mead Vickers? And Tony Brignall worked in the mail room there. I don't suppose any of these were there when you were there, were they?
They weren't. I tell you who was there was Frank Lowe.
Frank Lowe was there when you were there in the mailroom.
No, not in the mailroom. I went and worked for him as his assistant, and I had to cover for him when he was on holiday, which was a total bizarre. He was a controller.
Right.
Anybody less like a controller than me, I can't imagine. What was fun was the mailing room was fun. There were some black guys in the mailing room, Jamaican guys. We went into the white kids. Went into a training scheme, really. You know, we went into TV and different places, and I worked with Frank Lowe. But they stayed in the mailing room, and I was enraged by this. And I remember talking to the head of the mailing room and says, "How come they don't have training schemes like we do?" And he said, "Well, they're not qualified. It's despicable. It's a different world there." Yeah.
What did you get taught on the TV production course, JWT?
Well, no, I was taught anything. I would just. I remember watching John Schlesinger do cigarette commercials, and so I would watch and see this stuff. I was attached to a producer, a guy called Ted Southcott, who I thought was terrific, and he would, you know, drag me around as his assistant or tea boy or whatever to different commercials, and so. So I would look at that, and then I went on to a place called TVA, I remember it was, and where Peter Bijou, who I worked with later on, was working. He was a cameraman.
Yeah. And was that as a producer, Adrian?
Me? No, just as a T-boy, really. One interesting thing, I worked with a guy called Sir James Archibald, I think, who did a... he did a documentary on art and culture in Britain, and I did all of the research on it for him. You know, Mary Quant and Henry Moore and that sort of thing. You know, furniture, and it was a fabulous job, actually.
Oh wow! What was that called again?
It was called Art and Culture in Britain,
right.
And there was a marvellous director, who, because I knew him, I got them to use him, a guy called Don Levy, an Australian, right, who did a very interesting sort of experimental movie called Herostratus. And his idea for this, which was a very good idea, his idea for this documentary was that each segment would be directed not by him, but by whoever was featured, like whether it was Mary Quant or Henry Moore.
Okay.
So it's a good idea. So they directed their own segments. Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, it was a good idea. And it wasn't bad. I mean, this guy, Don Levy, did a marvelous documentary called Time Is that that I saw and loved.
So what was your role in all of this? Because you seem aware of filmmakers and to have a view on it at the time.
Well, I didn't have a...
What was your job?
I don't think I had a credit or anything like that on this art and culture film, but I did all of the research for him. I mean, it was me really who got it together pretty much, and I enjoyed doing that. And then I worked in different production companies. I worked at Brooks Baker Fulford, and I sort of learnt about lighting from Len Fulford. Just watching him really.
Both photographers.
Yes, they were.
Just watching him light.
Bob Brooks learned from him. He said, "I'll give you all of my work," he said, "if you tell me about lighting," and he did. Yeah, funny, right?
I've never heard that.
But Len was masterful. He did mainly sort of still life stuff, and he showed me. It was very interesting. He showed me, if he had like tomatoes or potatoes or and a bit of steak or whatever. He says, "What you have to do is just slap it down." He said, "Just stick it down. Don't think about it. Slap it down." And he said, if it doesn't work straight away, you know it's going to be another 4 hours. Do you see what I'm saying? And he was dead right. You know, he just had an instinctive way of sticking this stuff down and it looking good. You know, without thinking about it. It was instinctive. And so I sort of learned from that a bit.
And is that a tip you would use even today, presumably?
No, absolutely. But Bob was...
Yeah, brilliant.
Bob Brooks was very different. He was a sweet man, but very bad tempered. And I remember him, everybody was petrified of him. And I remember I watched him do, he was exactly the opposite of Len. He spent hours with this sort of elaborate pile of vegetables and potatoes and all around a steaming thing of soup, right? And it was on a psych. Right. And he had to get in. He found it very difficult to get in with his Polaroid to check the reading. And he put his foot on the psych with his Polaroid camera.
Yeah.
And it shot the whole lot, the whole kibosh, shot like a boomerang, because of the psych. You see what I'm saying? It was bent.
Yeah.
And there was stuff falling for 5 minutes. And everybody was petrified.
So it was more from Len Fulford than Brooks.
I thought he was a natural, Len. I thought I liked to. Funny enough, I talked to him about co-directing the table. You know that I did a short film called The Table. I talked to Len Fulford about it, and he agreed to do it. And then I thought, fuck, I don't want to share it with him. You know, if it's any good, I want it to be you. So in the end, I didn't do it with him.
So in this time when you're sort of getting into advertising, directing, I read somewhere that you were slightly conscious of your accent being a little bit posh.
Well, I suppose I was really. I mean, it was a bit like, I mean, everybody would do a sort of reverse snobbery thing. I mean, you know, like David Bailey and Mick Jagger. I mean, they were all sort of posh, I suppose, middle class people. And I guess I was. I mean, I hated that. You know, I hated the whole public school thing and that accent. So I did fairly elaborately be Cockney.
Trying to get away from that. Being positioned as a sort of
posh, it's an alienating thing as well. You know, I hate the whole class system thing in in England, it's just so awful. And it hasn't really changed much, I don't think, when I go back.
So then you went to Trendy MNM.
There's a place called MRM. It was called MRM.
Oh, MRM, but it says it's Trendy.
I suppose it was sort of Trendy. There was a guy called John Burroughs who was the main editor, the main director, film director there. And I sort of I started producing commercials. I mean, laughingly, it was pathetic. You know, I had absolutely no idea how to produce. And I remember I would have a drawer in my office with all sorts of different currencies in it. And when I opened the door, it would all sort of shoot into the air because there was so much in there. I mean, that shows, you know, how good I was. I mean.
But what did you learn from them? There's a bit in one of the interviews, which is like a, sounds like a bit from Austin Powers. It says you were upstairs in MRM, and then came down in
St. Anne's Court.
St. Anne's Court. That's it. Came downstairs on the way down. Heard Paul McCartney singing "Hey Jude."
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Which sounds like something from Austin Powers in the swinging '60s that you're making commercials and here and that. So you were right above. That studio, Trident
Studio.
That's
exactly right. And I came down at about 8 o'clock. And funny enough, there's a book of all of the recording sessions of the Beatles. And it says the exact time that I was there on the stairs. It's funny. I remember coming down this, and he was doing that bit where and the scream at the top, you know. And it was absolutely blood-curdling. I mean, can you imagine hearing that for the first time?
And obviously, that's an unknown song, obviously.
Yeah. Totally. And in this, you know, quiet sort of the steps going down, total quiet. And so I pushed the door open, and I remember seeing, I didn't see Paul McCartney, but I remember seeing this tiny studio full of double basses and cellos, full to overflowing. And but this side, looking down into it, was John Lennon and Yoko Ono. I just saw them. So it really did feel like a bit of history. And it's a breathtaking song anyway. No, it's marvelous.
So how did it come? How did you get from there to Jenny & Co? I presume Jenny was more senior, otherwise it would have been Adrian & Co. But so how did you come to start Jenny?
Well, she started it, and I think she was funded by a man called James Garrett, who also had a production company. And I joined her and with Gower Frost. And she called me a director. It was hilarious. And we all sat in a room and did nothing for
right.
I mean, all stared at each other, and I think she based it on I did a title sequence for MRM. I don't know why they let me do it, but it with a girl called Vivian Neves, who was lovely looking, and I used stamps. It was just a sentence, you know, and it said something like, "This demonstration reel is produced by MRM Productions." And I had separate stamps, you know, like rubber stamps that you put into ink. Yes, but I did them on her. You know, I did them on her cheek and her neck and breast, I think, as far as I remember. So I did it in cuts, and it was quite sort of, it was quite good, actually. It worked quite well.
So you'd never done anything before that, and then...
No, nothing at all. And they used it, you know, and I guess she liked that. But I did, as I say, we sat in that room. There was a man called Peter Fensom who eventually gave Jenny some work. He was a very kind man. I've gotten his agency. Peter Fensom, SOME, yeah.
Fentham.
It's a little agency. It wasn't a famous one. But I watched, you know, for a lot. Then we went into our premises on Beak Street, and I sat and watched Alan Parker, because she got Alan Parker, who was then working with a man called Paul Windsor. They were working. Yeah. Paul Windsor was the visual side, and he was the dialogue side, and they worked together.
Right.
Until they parted company after a year, and I just watched them. I just sat on a stool, I remember, and, you know, just very envious and sad because I wasn't doing anything.
What would you have picked up from watching Alan and Paul?
Well, I mean, I didn't see them actually shoot. I just saw them working endlessly. I mean, he would work practically every week, and I was in my little sort of tiny office learning to type. I went to a place called, I forgot what it's called, but where you learned to type in unison without, you know, you all slam the keys down in unison when the tape recorder told you what to do, you know, F, S. But I never learned properly.
But you were obviously at this point angling to be a director.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that was my title. The first thing I'd have to say that I got a sort of a charity thing. It was a test commercial from Arnold Pierce, who was a sweet man, kind of a neurotic man, and he worried endlessly. But he was also a little courageous in that he gave me this test commercial for that I had to shoot for £600, I remember it cost. And I shot it in black and white. And it was for Shaw deodorant, and it was just on a girl's hands and a boy's hands, sort of caressing, stroking, and then clenching and trying to reproduce the idea of them making love, but through their hands. So I put them in bed, which was funny. So I only saw their hands, but I put them in bed, this couple. And it was very funny because they got quite excited, I guess, you would see their feet sort of wiggling and jumping around, you know what I'm saying? But it was just on what hands did together in the process of making love to them. And it sort of worked. It was quite good.
That sounds like a good brief.
Yeah, and it was a good idea, really. And then I sort of dyed it pink, you know, made it pink rather than black and white.
And what was your first major commercial, the one in Bishop's Avenue?
Well, that was the first one, yeah. The first real one. It was for Midnight Mint, I remember. And we were in this sort of palatial house in Bishop's Avenue. And I got fixated on a mirror that was it was a party, if you like. It was a dance, you know. And this little guy was dancing with this beautiful girl called Carrie Ann, I remember. She was a terrific model, actually. I got fixated with trying to shoot via the mirror, you know, so that I there'd be a focus pull or whatever, and I'd move off it and go onto the party. And it really wasn't very complicated, but it became more and more complicated in my mind. So literally it was like a roaring in my ears. The whole unit was watching me falling apart, basically. And it was just terrifying. I mean, literally a roaring in my ears. And I stared at this mirror for 3 or 4 hours and shot absolutely nothing in the morning, nothing. And I went to Jenny Armstrong, and said to her, I said, I cannot do this. Nothing on earth is worth this nightmare. I said, I'll go back to producing, so-called, you know, and I cannot do this. Nothing is worth this nightmare. And in the afternoon, it was like Jekyll and Hyde. It was just so bizarre in the afternoon. But I guess because I dismissed any idea of being a director, a film director, the afternoon went just sort of swimmingly. It was bizarre. It's like somebody has smiled down on from on high. It was amazing. And I did it in a state of almost ecstasy. I had such fun doing it. It was surreal, the difference between the afternoon and the morning. So God knows how it happened. I think God smiled. I just thought, oh, give him a break, you know?
So isn't that you took the pressure off by, you know, once you'd almost given up?
Yeah, I'd given up. Absolutely.
That you'd took the pressure off and you just enjoyed it, presumably, because you thought it doesn't matter.
That's right. Exactly like that. I love doing it. Yeah. Extraordinary.
So the test, the table. Now, I think it's really interesting, the table, because when most people, presumably you did that to bring in more work.
Well, not really. I mean, I wrote the script myself. It was sort of loosely based. Well, I mean, it wasn't autobiographical, but it was just a couple that are sort of breaking up, and the man's jealous and knows that she's done something, and so it's a dialogue over breakfast where you don't see the people, you just see their hands and what they do with their hands, you know. Yeah. So it reflecting their guilt or their mood or whatever, you know. So if somebody's stirring a cup of tea, for example, then, and she's asked a question, was David there or whatever, the tea stirring quickens up, you know what I'm saying, because it's a smoke screen.
Yeah.
And I did a lot with, you know, the coffee pot being slammed down. It was all in ultra close up. I mean, very, very tight, you know, so that the coffee was spilling along a groove in the table, but really, really tight on it. And an egg was getting carved up like it's bleeding. She said, it sounds very pretentious, but it did. Yeah, it did work, really. And what was interesting, and I think to this day it's really a little different, is because I extended the moments, because I did stuff in slow motion and made more of the visual, I had to then fill in that extra time with dialogue. And what I did was I repeated dialogue, right, you know, twice, three times, four times, and it became an interesting sort of, almost a surreal sort of exercise. It worked quite well, I think.
Still looks amazing. I think it's interesting. I suppose my question was going to be that at the time, that didn't look like advertising.
No.
But if you go 5 years after that, there's a lot of, it does look more like advertising. I would, in the sense that it must have influenced a lot of people. I spoke to a creative called Graham Fink. I don't know whether you know Graham Fink. And I said, look, have you seen this, Graham? You'd like this. And he said, oh, I'm really familiar with that. Tim Mellors showed me that. He said, and I used to rip that off all the time when I was a director.
That's funny, really.
That's like 20 years later. He won't mind me saying that. But he used it all the time as a reference 20 years later. And I wonder how that went down at the time, because it didn't look like ads that were on the TV, did it?
Well, I got a lot of still life stuff as a result of that, you know, but I didn't do it, but I did it just because I like the story. I like the sort of, well, I just like the idea, really. And I've never really been interested in advertising at all. You know, yeah. I was never interested in whether they sold the stuff or not. If they're any good, the ad, they would sell it. You know, they would sell the product or whatever. But I was never interested in the advertising side of it. I just wanted to make little films, you know, and learn how to do it.
I find it interesting looking at some of your commercials. I would think, how did you make the choice to choose that? So the coal ones are a good example, because the scripts must literally say someone walks home and they're cut to them by the fire. And you think, I wonder why he's... obviously, you've seen what you can make that, but most people would think there's not much there. And obviously, when you see the films, the guy, the fisherman or the woman with a school bus, they're very engaging and evocative and great to look at. But as a script, I can't imagine what you would have been sent in, or whether you would send in something that you then changed to what you felt would be.
Well, I did, really. I mean, it was just they were just really a sort of sketch in a way. But I was very lucky because they let me do pretty much what I wanted to do, you know? And you know, I like to make them look nice, but what for me was important, and I think what made them work, was the humanity in it, the little pieces of humanity, you know.
Mm.
Just casting the kid right, mate. Do you see what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah, totally. It's,
you know, I did, you know, milk stuff with that little kid, you know, which is,
yeah,
kind of nice. But it's the observation with the kid, you know. It's not making it generic. It's making it specific. And that's a lot of fun.
Well, the kids seem particularly radiant. Well, from the table, the kid, I think that's your son, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, Louis, yeah.
Right through to Dark Water.
Deep Water. Deep Water.
Deep Water, sorry. The kids seem particularly natural and radiant, and there's something about them that pops. And as you say, you know, in some of the ads, I don't know why that is. I don't know whether that's, but they just seem particularly, and.
Well, I think it may be because I'm a child myself. And I think that helps, you know. And I think that applies to all actors, really, is if you show that you're vulnerable, if you show that you'll do anything for you'll make a fool of yourself for them, do anything right at all to help them. I think you then tend to get the same thing back from them. They right. show their vulnerability, and you know, it's easy for a director, I guess, to be sort of dictatorial in a way, but I've never done that, you know, because I don't think that would work. You wouldn't get anything out of that.
It's interesting that. So obviously, you know, well, there is a sort of thread that they're all pop out in a totally natural, vibrant something. I don't know what the connective tissue is, but maybe it's that, just that the way you appeal to them and deal with them makes them.
I think what also is, you see, one of the things that I've thought about quite a lot is that I think I should be called a selector. I don't think I should be called a director, yeah, because you're selecting in a casting, you're selecting in the cut. You're it's a process of selection. Everything. And you know what I like with things, with the Levi's stuff I did, for example. What was lovely then was that, yeah, you know there'll be a couple of kids playing in the dust somewhere out in the desert, you know, and they really did look like a sort of what's his name, that American artist who does archetypal America.
The one who used to do the covers of the.
Yes, exactly right. Him.
Rockwell, yeah. Norman Rockwell.
Well, you know, there was this couple playing, and it's just these two little girls, you know, I remember on the. And what was fun was just grabbing them and just saying, look at the camera. You know, just take a hand and just look at me. And sticking that in the ad. It's fucking marvelous, you know. But I don't think, you know, now you'd need to get permission and all of that stuff. But I used to loved grabbing at things. Again, selecting stuff. You know, if there'll be a crop duster going past, you know, well, you know, those things in the desert where, you know, they're doing the vegetables or whatever, and they're about 5 foot off the ground, and they're marvelous. They're swooping up in the air, you know, just sticking that in. And I didn't know it was going to be there.
Well, that was one of my questions, which is it feels like your antennae is always up. Rather than having a very fixed storyboard that it's going to be this to this to this, you're sort of open and constantly looking around for what can be used, which is a little bit unusual.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I've always, in a way, I thought, fuck, I'd rather be a photographer because it's just me. You know, I don't have to have 30 or 40 people hanging around waiting for what I want to do, and which obviously takes away from spontaneity.
Yeah.
But so I try to keep it as spontaneous as possible, and grabs. I mean, but it drives people crazy because there's a schedule and stuff, but I love doing that, love it. And I try and do it in movies as well, as much as I can.
Well, there was a little list I'd made of just things like spotting Jennifer Beals taking her bra off under her shirt, thinking we'll have that.
Yeah.
The guy with the weird laugh, think we can use him more. You know, just pick it, having your antennae up to see what's around you rather than just how do you shoot what's in front of you.
That's exactly right. Who was the guy with the weird laugh? Oh, I don't know. That was in Flashdance.
That was in Flashdance as well, yeah. He just had a weird laugh.
Yeah, I remember him, yeah.
That ended up being a big...
That's right.
Being quite a well-known laugh. But obviously you don't look for a guy with that laugh. So you're sort of picking up these things as and when they come at you, but you're, as you say, you're selecting these things. I mean, I suppose it makes me wonder kind of where does your aesthetic come from, which I know is like a difficult thing to answer, but it seems like lots of things that you, certainly early on, that you were using were the things that other people were rejecting. So things like the frame being burnt out, it being too dark, it being too close, you know, all of that stuff that was very considered problems. Yes. At the time.
But what specifically do you mean?
I think that particularly your ads from the 70s don't look like other people's ads. Good. To me. And there's, you know, so they're either the things that other people would reject, like lens flare, everything burnt out because it's too bright, everything being too dark, you know, all of those things that people avoid. It seems like you're embracing those.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I was looking at that Levi's commercial, not the Route 66 one, the other one, which I think is quite good. What's it called, Samantha? That tune in the Levi's commercial, in the sunshine something or whatever. Was it a good?
Yeah, Love Grows, is it?
Yeah, that's right. There's a reason, yeah. But I remember thinking that it wasn't bad because there was a little thread of a couple going out. I mean, you know, when she kissed the shit out of him against that caravan. Yeah. What do they call them? Those Airstream things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then they have a fight or whatever. But it's a real fight. And then she wallops him, you know, and knocks him off.
Yeah.
And you'd never be able to do that now. I mean, there's no way on God's earth that, you know, that they were sticking in. Because, I mean, she hauled off and he didn't know he was going to get hit.
Did he not? No.
But it's fun, you know, when it's it feels genuine, it feels real. It doesn't feel like a generic sort of... And that's what I, you know, like to try and do.
Well, they're like bits out of a documentary again, which was unusual for the time. And is this the period when you were being pushed around in a wheelchair?
Yes, no, I did all of the operating myself, and a lot of handheld things. In fact, one of the problems I had when I started doing movies, you know, when I started doing when I did Foxes, and I was operating that myself as well, all of the moves, you know, the handheld moves and stuff that I got used to doing in commercials that lasted for, say, 4 or 5 seconds or whatever, all of a sudden had to last longer. They had to last 12 seconds or 14 seconds. So do you see what I'm saying? Within a scene.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a big problem, really, was suddenly having to adjust that.
So why did you decide to start operating yourself to make it trickier when you started off in
well, because I got frustrated trying to describe to an operator what I wanted.
Just putting someone in the way, yeah.
There was a very sweet guy called Peter Ewins, who was an operator that I used a lot, and he put up with me. You know, most of the time he wouldn't be operating because I was doing it, but sometimes he'd get frustrated with me. And I remember what he said. He would say, hang on. He was saying, oh, let's get this bolted down. He says, hang on. Because he'd become so frustrated with me. I'd be, let's do a top shot. You know, no, we'll do it from down here. You know, and the poor bastard was running around trying to keep up with me. But he was a sweet man. He was a good operator, actually. Anyway, it's that thing of keeping it spontaneous, of not having it lose energy. And I've always tried to make sure there's a layer that you're not just doing the page out of the script. I mean, for example, in Decent Proposal, there's a fight between Demi Moore and Woody Harrelson. And
yeah,
just prior to doing this scene, I guess a week before or something, I'd had this enormous fight with my wife, Samantha, you know. And I remember in the middle of the fight, looking down and seeing that she was wearing these yellow gloves. She had been in the middle of doing the washing up. And there were studs sort of coming off the ends of them. And I remember thinking, fuck, I've got to use that, because it's like a layer that said, this is real. She's actually doing washing up, and the row happened in the middle of it. It didn't happen at the beginning of with the clapperboard. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Something happened before.
It's that. It's to get that feeling of, oh, it didn't start with a clap. Because I've always thought that, you know, the whole process of filming is just awful. You know, guy yelling for quiet and you know, the red light and the bell. Yeah. And now everybody's scared. Everybody's fucking panic-stricken, you know, because they're frightened, you know.
Yeah,
and so I've always tried to make the process as informal as possible. And I often put the clapperboard on at the end, you know, rather than terrifying everybody at the beginning.
So do you think that's one of the positives about digital filming?
Oh, it is. That I really enjoyed. I love the fact that you did, you know, that you could just augment natural light or use it. I love that. You know, the idea of that used to drive me crazy. You know, the cameraman would be 3 hours or 4 hours lighting the setup, and it looked much better before he fucked around with it. You know, maybe when it was natural light. But the idea of waiting 4 hours and then having 3/4 of an hour, if I'm lucky, to shoot the scene was crazy. But having said that, there's something about film. It's more specific or something. I think because there's maybe a danger. This is interesting, actually. Maybe there's a danger in that digital is easy. Maybe it shouldn't be easy.
Yeah. So people concentrate less because it's so easy to cover more.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, there's a certain anxiety and energy that's like, this is serious, rather than we can try this. So I'm sort of, I'm interested in these visual bits and pieces that you were. So I noticed in Deep Water, there's a couple of shots. There's one that I thought, God, what the hell is this? And it was when she was swimming up into this big pink wobbly thing that I couldn't get my head around.
Yes, it was like a rubber ring thing.
Yeah, it turns out to be a rubber ring, but it was like a very striking, unusual thing. And then there's the little black sailor toy that drops into the bath. And you mentioned the yellow rubber gloves with a foam on. You know, picking up all these, where that comes from to be so observant of these kind of bits and pieces.
Well, again, it's selecting, isn't it? I mean, what's so fascinating is the whole editing process, really, is just how things change so dramatically, you know. I mean, in that scene where you talk about that rubber ring thing, there was a, you know, it was a shot of two girls in bikinis or whatever coming down the stairs, and then people splashed into the pool or whatever. And when you had it in, it felt cheesy. It felt a bit tacky. And so what's interesting is just sort of gradually peeling the stuff out, you know, gradually making it more precise. But then you can take too much out.
Yeah.
And now I'm agonizing, you know, for, it's funny because people in Deep Water, people saw the snails in a kind of a sexual connotation, you know, like sperm or whatever. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right. And oh, really?
Well. I'm just talking about some of the reviews. You know, I've always been castigated with reviews. They've always murdered my ass, really. I mean, not all of them, but a lot of them. And you know, I did, for example, I did a movie called Jacob's Ladder, and I remember the reviews when it came out.
Yeah.
They said this is gobbledygook.
Right.
Literally gobbledygook. They said it doesn't make a word of sense. And now it's a movie that's become a movie of reference. And it's been copied a lot.
And is that because of your commercials background?
Oh, that's brutal. I mean, they never let that die, ever.
Because obviously it feels like if you come from a commercials background like yourself, you can't make things look interesting or nice because that's commercials. Whereas other people, you know, Terrence Malick or whoever, you know, they don't seem to get hammered for the way they frame stuff or looking interesting.
You're right, it is. I mean, and they never let you forget it. I don't know why. I think it's because it's convenient, you know. I mean, people love to, you know, give you labels, you know. I mean, one thing that does piss me off enormously is sexuality is part of any relationship. But in America, they have this way of equating sex with smutty or sleazy or whatever. Those two adjectives always come hand in hand with any kind of sexuality, which is so fucking absurd.
Well, it's a repressed society, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is specifically over here. You can hack any number of heads off or arms off or whatever, but you...
Yeah, but that's all just good fun, yeah.
But people are terribly nervous about sex here, you know. And it's so stupid to isolate it because it's part of the fucking whole. It doesn't make any sense.
There's one ad I was gonna mention that I particularly like. A guy called Dave Trott was talking about it recently. Said two things. A, he said he was on a shoot once. Anyway, and the electrician was moaning. It was your shoot. And said, if this was Alan Parker, we'd be out at four. He said, we're going to be here all night with him.
That's funny, really.
He'd be messing about, you know, changing stuff. So that was one of the stories he told me. And then the other one, he said, you've got to look at the Mary Quant ad. He said, it's like nothing I've ever seen. So, and it is. I mean, if you run that today, the Mary Quant ad, it would be like nothing on TV. I mean, I don't know what the question is, really. What did you say? It's such an unusual aesthetic.
Well, I was always interested in the kind of, you know, Giacometti, you know, little skinny sculptures. I was always interested in the quality that throwing something out of focus a certain amount against a backlit sky or whatever, or a white surface or whatever, you know, the way the head almost separates from the body.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting thing to look at, you know. So it was really exploiting that and making the only sharp bits be the product, you know, when she's putting the... So it was quite a good way, I thought, of emphasizing actually the advertising part. I'm surprised she didn't use it, really. I showed it to her. I don't know whether she actually saw it. It went to Mary Quant. But, and it was also a lesbian love story, if you like, which I liked.
Right.
You know, when they came together at the end, you saw it was two girls. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose with all these things, I'm trying to get... You bring a really unusual take to these things. And when you describe it there, you make it sound like, oh, it's just common sense. You know, you make them out of focus, a bit like Giacometti, two lesbians between them. As if, why would you not do that? That's the obvious answer. But obviously, it's not. You look at it and it's not like any other stuff then or now. And also, the other thing is the foghorn. I mean, that's one of the things I noticed is the foghorn.
Oh, the foghorn, yeah.
There's a foghorn that... Well, and it feels like that in lots of your commercials, you used sound design before it was called sound design. It feels, and I wonder whether that goes back to your trumpet at St. Michael's Hall or wherever.
I'm not sure whether I wonder if it was Brian Eno. It might have been. I'm not sure about
was
that.
It?
Maybe not. It was a focal, and you're right. And it was nice because the focal, the intervals of the focal were arbitrary. They weren't when you would expect them to be.
No.
So that worked quite well, I think.
But that seems, I don't know how much, I presume you were very involved in the music because across all of them, there's a real, across all of your ads particularly, there's such a range of musical styles and it's all so integral to the, it's so Good. Tied together with the visuals
yeah.
that I can only imagine you were very involved.
Well, I was, yes. There was a sweet man I did quite a lot with. The Burly Brass one. Actually, no. It was the one where the girl's going up the steps. Not Mick Jagger's wife. What's her name?
Jerry Hall.
Yeah, not that one. That was a Burly one as well, I think. The other one had a lovely track. It was mostly double bass, just double bass. And the guy who I used the same. I've forgotten what his name is. But he was also an agency producer, but he did music tracks, and I used him a lot. It's the same with I've always worked very closely with Maurice Jarre or Morricone. You know, I got to know them as, and I think it did help that I understood, you know, like what a diminished chord was or whatever, you know, without actually be able to read music and stuff, but. Or a ninth or whatever. I mean, at least being able to sort of talk their language a little bit helped.
Well, I know. Stim Flashdance, you suggested, was it in Maniac?
Oh, I did, yeah. Bing bong, bing bong, bing bong.
Which obviously they took up and used. So I can only presume you're always all over that stuff.
Well, yes. What's his name? Phil Ramone. He was the. I was very.
Oh, that's it, Phil Ramone. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a lovely man. Lovely man. He's dead now. But I worked very closely with him. But I'd heard that sort of bing bong bing bong. That sort of in a craft. I stole it from a Kraftwerk tune. But he was such a sweet man. Saying, "Well, good. Let's try that." And it worked good.
So what about back to things like Brutus Jeans On? That was composed. Would you have been quite involved in that? Would you have had a view?
You know, I've forgotten a little bit. What I do remember very strongly was that I hadn't done The Boys by 6 o'clock.
Right.
And the client was there and was so enraged that he says... I'm gone, I'm out of here, and I'm not paying for this.
Yeah, wow.
And I literally said that. And I remember looking at Gower and thinking, fuck, what do we do now? You know, and he said, I'm not paying for this. And then I was, so anyway, we went on, did The Boys. You know, I probably finished about, in fact, I did finish about 11 o'clock as far as I remember. But they, it's interesting what you say about the music. I've forgotten. Anyway, they ran out of jeans. I mean, it was so popular, and it became, I think it became a number one, the actual, they changed the words.
It did. It was a great track.
Yeah.
It was the guy who did the soundtrack to With Nail and I, which is a film I like.
Interesting.
Yeah, David Dundas. So
they had to stop putting the ad out because they couldn't produce enough jeans. Literally.
I read that. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, funny, right? He did pay in the end.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he did.
Did you ever put on a pair of Brutus jeans?
I never did. No, I was always a Levi's.
No, I didn't. I didn't have you down as a Brutus guy.
I was always a Levi's man myself.
Yeah, I mean they were weirdly done within both massive. Big successful commercials, both for jeans, both within about 6 months.
It's funny, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah, strange.
Weird, right?
So, when we spoke last, you said you didn't do much for Collets. There's a couple of things on this. Which is, one, someone said, and now that you said you used to work for Frank Lowe, it makes a bit more sense, which is someone said Frank would often say, this was Dave Brown told me this, we've got to find ways to use Adrian, he's brilliant.
Did he?
Yeah.
That's good. I did that Ford one, the long Ford one. That was the biggest. It was the longest commercial I'd ever done. I think it was 2.5 minutes or something.
Was that the one with the guy from The Professionals? I can't remember his name now.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that guy. It was like a little love story, you know, which sort of worked.
Well, I mean, just from my little bit of research, I can find that you did Bird's Eye, you did a Ford, you did Nescafe, various things for them, but.
Oh, I did, okay.
I'll tell you the thing that occurred to me, which is Collets used to be very, used to do brilliant stuff, but it was very straight in a way. And yours was much more visual artsy. I don't know what you want to describe it as. But ironically, the two most famous Collets film by the end of the 70s would be much more in your camp than where they started, which would be Fiat Strada and Benson and Hedges' Iguana.
Yeah, I never saw that.
Where they? Do you know those ones?
No, I don't.
You know the one where they fly in the packet of cigarettes and drop it into the pool?
No, you know I don't.
Both Hugh Hudson.
Oh, that's interesting, really.
I'll send them to you. But they're much more. They're not like the where they started. So it's just interesting where you'd started and where they ended up.
That's funny.
I wonder whether they came nearer to you, because obviously there was a time when you were saying you didn't used to get that much work from them.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I wasn't thinking too hard about it really, but I remember I used to work with Andy Rourke a lot, and I like working with him. We used to have furious arguments, and I always think it's good if you argue about stuff, because quite often, you know, something better than either of you thought about comes out of it, you know. So it's good to fight a bit, and
it's good to have something to fight against. Yeah.
He died very young, the poor man.
Did he?
Yeah, he retired, and he died on a safari. The poor bastard. I mean, it's shocking.
Oh,
lovely man. He turned his Range Rover over or something, and it was nowhere. You know, and they had to fly a little plane in.
So which directors did you admire? I mean, obviously you were in competition with Hugh Hudson, who's just died, sadly.
Yeah.
Ridley Scott, Tony Scott.
Well, I used to look at Ridley's a lot. We would get each other's reels in, you know, and run them backwards and forwards and try and work out whether something was a track or a zoom or both. You know, right. we would look at each other's work a lot, you know, on the Steinbeck or whatever, you know, and so we were rivals obviously. And we'd see, and Soho was so nice. I mean, we'd all go to Terrazza,
right,
for lunch, you know, and people drunk a lot then, you know. I don't know what do they do still, but you know,
don't think so.
Huh?
I don't think as much what I hear.
It didn't seem to matter much. I mean, we were incredibly passionate. I remember getting back from Australia with Gower and us making a point of going straight into the office, having been on a plane for whatever it was, 15 hours or something. But there was this marvellous sort of romantic feeling of being absolutely fucking knackered, but loving what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, in driven by tremendous competition, I read somewhere that after you'd seen Hugh Hudson's first film, you came out barely able to talk.
Which one was it?
I think I looked it up before we started. I think Chariots of Fire, presumably.
Yes,
that was his first one.
Probably. I felt the same way when I saw Gladiator.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah, I wanted to throw up. I thought it was so good.
But obviously, that's a really useful.
But then I heard that Ridley got his crew in to watch Jacob's Ladder, the fight at the beginning of that, when these guys freak out, and he said, "I wanted to be like that man," he said. So I was very flattered about that.
But obviously, that kind of competition must have massively driven you on.
Well, I think so. Yeah, it was terrific
to have those people to compete against.
It was terrific. Yeah. And what was lovely was it was sort of instant gratification. Really, you'd shoot the commercial, you'd cut it in a week or whatever, and then it would be out the following week or 2 weeks later, and that was marvelous because you couldn't wait for it to come out and people start talking about it, and because. Yeah, they really did like them, you know, they really...
And how did you start working in the States? You seem to have done a ton of stuff for Chiat Day.
Oh, I did do mostly for... I did do quite a lot for them.
Honda, Yamaha, Apple.
Yeah, that one with Kevin Costner.
With Kevin Costner, yeah.
But they weren't so good as the English ones, really. I don't. The ideas weren't as good, really, I would say.
What, in the American ads?
Yeah, I quite like the Jovan thing, but I did my own version of that. That What Is Sexy thing. I thought that was pretty good. That was fun.
Did you? Yeah, the music's great in that.
Yes, it was good. It was dead right. The music track was marvelous, frenetic, sort of lunatic thing.
In, I think, 76, you said you hope in 10 years to be directing features, directing movies, and you were doing that in 3 years.
Yeah.
How did that come about? Because on the face of it, you weren't doing what would have been considered the narrative type things that, say, Ridley Scott was doing at the time.
But they saw my reel and they liked it a lot. I remember Don Simpson liked it a lot.
Right.
Before I did Flashdance. I mean, I turned down Flashdance. I thought it was just silly, you know, but eventually did it because I could see they were going to make it, you know, and I thought that maybe I could make the dances look good, you know. But it was Putnam, really. I met Putnam. I knew him a little bit in England, and I met him when I was doing, a Levi's commercial, and he threw this script of Fox's at me, and he said, "Tell me what you think of this." He said, "You won't do it because you're English and they want an American." And then he had a meeting at United Artists. I remember this. We went in there and he suddenly leapt to his feet and started swearing and shouting and saying, "I'd do anything to get this fucking movie off," and swearing over and over, he was barely making any sense at all, but I think it was his passion,
right?
And they could understand, and they could blame him, I guess, if it was a screw up. So I owe him a lot, you know.
And that was Fox's.
Yeah, it was Fox's. Yeah, and I researched it. I always remember he said once, and I disagree with it. He said, on Fox, he said, Sally Kellerman came in to him in his office and says, "What do you think of this?" It was like a raincoat or an overcoat or something like that. And he said he suddenly realized that he didn't know. And he realized he shouldn't be doing the movie because he didn't know. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. It is interesting, isn't it? But I didn't know, see, because I sat in the back of a school called Taft in the Valley, and I learnt about the difference between Valley kids and surfer kids. You know, the surfer kids all had combs in the back of their jeans, and the jeans were always too long. They trod on the ends, and it was like a uniform for the surfer kids at that stage. And I spent 3 weeks sitting in a school, looking at watching these people and seeing them work. So I disagree with them. I mean, you have to. It's like if you see Das Boot. Do you remember that submarine?
Yeah, yeah,
commanders?
Yeah.
Well, you didn't have to be a submarine commander to be able to do that movie as well as that German. I thought I'd forgotten his name.
Yeah.
Guy did. So you make yourself you immerse yourself in the subject and you learn about it, and you have to become an expert, and that's what's fun about it.
But again, you've your eye to pick up all these things, like their jeans are slightly too long, they've got a comb in. That seems unusual to me.
Well, I love those details.
To spot all those details, like the washing up gloves.
Yeah, it is, exactly. I mean, I love, you're mentioning this, and there's a thing in what's it called? In Unfaithful. I think. I mentioned to her, and I really like the moment. She comes in, and she's just started having an affair with Martinez, the French guy.
Yeah, the French.
She's with Richard Gere, and she says, can I get you anything? He says, no, I'm fine. He says, and then he says, out of the blue, he says, do you love me? I forgot what her name was.
Yeah.
And she said, of course.
Diane Lane.
Don't be silly. And he said, I guess I'm feeling silly. And then she goes out and she switches the light off on him. And that had happened to me, actually. Hopefully not for the same reason. But my wife did that. And I remember thinking, fuck, what a marvelous beat. Because it's like trying to extinguish you from their life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I love that. See, I love layers like that. You know, when you have something specific and so awful, so she has to put the light on again. You know, she's leaving, so not to leave him in pitch darkness. You know, that's marvelous. So that's why I do this, really, is to try and find those. I mean, this is nothing. This is nothing. But there was a cafe in France. I remember these guys, they're having a good time. You know, they're a little drunk and stuff. Then they all get up, and this guy... it's lost, but he gets up and his chair falls over. His chair falls over, and then he puts the chair back and he leaves with them. But just the fact that his chair fell over was just made the scene real. And so I am waiting to be able to maybe do one more of these things, I hope, to get that in, to have a guy knock the chair over. It's funny, Robert Redford said to me once, he says, what's strange, he says, is nobody ever drops anything in a movie. They never drop anything.
That's interesting,
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So presumably you've since had a few things dropped from then on.
Yes, probably.
Have you? Probably dropped the odd fork or something.
No, absolutely.
But yeah, no, it is.
Yeah, because it is. Again, it becomes
all that artifice, yeah.
Some it's specific, some it's not. You know, everything balanced and right, and
well, it goes back to your gloves analogy, that any of those bits that make it feel real.
That's right.
So I read that you said if you made 9.5 weeks again, you'd make it less visual.
Well, I do,
which seems a shame in a way.
Well, I don't. I just thought it. You know, it was a choice to make it in a slightly stylized way, and. Did I tell you about the scene that I didn't put in?
No. I did read there was a 4-hour cut somewhere.
Yeah, it was quite good. It was, and it. She always goes on about it. Kim Basinger talks about that because she liked it very much. There's a scene, for example, where he gets her to take pills, thinking that she's committing suicide for him. And it was it was a terrific scene, but it was, terrific, really. But there was a scene in it that I didn't. I mean, when I tested the movie, people were so irate that half the theatre would walk out, literally half the theatre. I became frightened, because they were yelling at the screen, if you can imagine. And on one particular occasion, I went and hid in the projection box. because I really didn't want to be there at the end, And there were executives there and God knows what.
So they had that scene where she was going to take pills.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was a good scene. Good scene. And I remember him hanging on to her arm. He wouldn't let go of her arm, and she kept saying, "Let go of me, Mickey, let go of me, Mickey." And then she started to cry, and I'd actually told him that she looked too fresh, that you didn't believe it was the end of 9 weeks of a relationship or whatever. But there was a scene in the novel that was just marvelous, because it summed up the sadomasochistic aspect of the relationship, and it was awful, really. But I thought I should have shot it. I chickened out. I didn't. He's watching a ball game, right?
Right.
And she's in handcuffs, and she, above her head, and they're on a sort of a hook. You know what I'm saying? Her feet are on the ground. It's not like she's hanging or something. But her feet, it was sort of a little painful, and she starts to moan, and she says, I've forgotten what his name was, but she says, she starts to get fed up because she's watching the ball game and ignoring her totally. And she's on the wall. And then she starts to sort of cry a little bit, and he still ignores her. And then she starts to cry big time, I guess because it's really hurting her. And he puts the TV off, and then he fucks her, and it's like the fuck of the century. But because of the pain as well, which was part of their relationship. But I think I'd have been lynched.
Is that not something for the director's cut 30th, 40th anniversary?
I didn't shoot.
Oh, you didn't shoot it? Oh, I thought you shot it.
It was in the novel.
Oh, okay.
It was in the novel. And it was a But I just thought, you know, afterwards, I thought, I'm crazy not to have done it, because it was just, because that summed up the essence of their relationship, which involved pain.
So obviously, given that you've shot so many films in America, you know, the Christian right and their sort of sensitivity to all this stuff.
Yes.
You've not chosen the easiest scripts to give them.
No, I suppose not. But again... you know, Fatal Attraction was a thriller, really, and obviously, people are inclined to notice the sexuality. The fact there's only 2 minutes of it in a 2-hour, 10-minute film, doesn't make any difference. That's what they notice.
Yeah,
which is strange, really. I mean, I don't understand it. Why they have to isolate the sexuality and you get this endless smut and...
On balance, this is a tricky question, but on balance, you obviously, in theory, get wiser as you get older. You are fitter when you're younger. What's better, shooting 40 years ago or now, your next feature?
Well, it's interesting, really. I mean, I didn't feel that any physical... drawback on the last one on Deep Water. I was getting up at 5 a.m, the usual thing. I did, you know, people in the main couldn't catch up with me. You know, I'm very sort of enthusiastic, and I think it catches on with the crew. So, I mean, you have more aches and pains and stuff. I always remember that. Trintignant, Jean-Louis Trintignant is one of my favorite actors, and I had dinner with him, and he says, if I don't wake up hurting somewhere, he said, I'll be dead. Now he is dead.
So he was right.
But he was like a little kid, you know, and he had terrific. It was marvelous. All I did was stare at him. It's funny.
Really?
Yeah, it's weird. It's a lovely thing, I think, between actors. You know, the actors and a director who haven't worked together. It's an interesting sort of almost like a little love story. You're sort of, what would it be like? Well, I could see that he was sizing me up, and I was sizing him up because I just love his work, you know.
Like a courtship.
Yeah, it is courtship. You're right. It's funny, and it doesn't matter whether it's a boy or a girl, you know, because you get so close to them. You become like a shrink, really.
Yeah.
For the 10 weeks or 12 weeks of it, you know him better than anyone. They'll tell you anything.
Particularly, as you say, you open yourself up to them to reveal yourself, to make them more relaxed.
That's right, yeah.
Which actors do you wish you could have worked with?
Oh, Hackman.
Yeah.
I would have loved to work with him. I nearly worked with De Niro twice. Funny enough, he wanted to do Silence, that one you were talking about, the right. Race riot, you know, the interracial story, and he wanted to do it, and I couldn't get the money with him, if you can imagine that.
That's unbelievable. So the two of you together couldn't get the money to do that. How can that be?
They didn't want to do it. I've nearly done it with lots of people. Colin Firth nearly did it, and then he changed his mind. And who's the one who did Taken? What's his, the Irish actor? What's his name?
Oh,
I blanked on his name. He was going to do it.
Picture him, yeah. So are you still trying to make that happen? Or is
I would
that...
love to do it. There's one I want to do called One Neck, which is about a serial killer who comes to a party in the Hamptons, which is very bizarre. I think right. Good. One Neck is called.
One Neck.
Yeah.
I'll keep an eye out for it.
Yeah, yeah. I really want to do that.
So is there any advice you'd give a young Adrian Lyne listening to this who wants to get into film? I mean, it's obviously a very different business today.
Well, I think it's much easier to do a short film now than it was. I mean, before video and stuff like that. I mean, that having to do it on 35 mil or what, having to do it on film, yeah, is a more involved, obviously, than just shooting it on video. And I think the thing is to have it doesn't matter how long it is, and I think it's great. I mean, I think the table, that little screen, yeah, I did is really quite good, and I think it's good because it was short apart from anything else. It's tough to bore people when it's 10 minutes long.
Yeah.
But I think what's really important is to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Just think of it in terms of acts. Where's the end of the first act? Where's the end of the second act? Rather than just saying, oh, it's just experimental, I'm not this. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. So I would imagine that's the, as we discussed before, that's the problem with digital, is now the table could be 2.5 hours long, because it's not based on cost or film.
That's right.
Film cost or crew. They could shoot it a ludicrously long version of it. So having those disciplines can be helpful sometimes.
I think so. And I was trying to say that earlier on, the difference. I mean, I really enjoyed shooting digital, but I'm not sure that the discipline is quite there. The fact that the other way is more difficult, maybe that's good.
Possibly brought more adrenaline.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. It was just such a weird movie, Deepwater. I was at complete loggerheads with the studio who wanted me to give a reason at the beginning of the movie for why they were alienated like that. And I just wanted to drop the audience in the middle of it. I didn't want to... I wanted them to work it out for themselves, rather than be told, they wanted a scene where he, for example, he says, look, I'm fed up with this. You do it. You do what the hell you want for 6 months or whatever. And then you'll come back with your tail between your legs. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I thought that was just boring,
I thought that was the point of it, because you're following it along, trying to figure out what their relationship is and how it works.
That's right.
Before I left today, I said to my son, 17, you should watch that. He said he really likes Ben Affleck. So, of course, the first thing he does is go on Rotten Tomatoes and start looking at scores.
Oh, yeah.
Disaster. So I said, you don't need to worry about that. It's like walking down the high street asking a big group of people. Just watch it. I watched it last week. You'll like it. But it's just funny how they approach it in a different way. But
of course.
Yeah.
But that's applied to me. I mean, I watched, I had a pile of of reviews of 9.5 weeks when it came out, and it was like they had defecated on the newspaper one by one, or thrown up on it. I mean,
oh, wow.
It was so...
Which was worse, the defecation or the
fart? It was probably both at once. I mean, I've never. I have to say, it was devastating, really, because I worked really hard on the fucking thing, and I thought that Mickey was good. You know, Mickey's such an interesting actor.
So you must be quite resilient to keep bowling through these issues.
I think so, because, you know, in a little bit of an arrogant way, you know, I think you get, sometimes you get proven right, you know, like with Jacob Slatter is a movie I'm really proud of, you know, but when it came out, they said, what the fuck? This is a lot of gobbledygook. I remember it.
Can you think of a film of yours that's had good reviews then? Because most...
Well, not really. Yes, a short film that I did with Peter Barkworth called Mr. Smith.
Oh, I couldn't find that. Mr. Smith, yeah.
Yeah, I got fabulous reviews on that. I sat down in the Carlton on the floor with all of the reviews around me, and they were marvellous, absolutely marvellous.
Was that on the BBC then, Adrian?
No, it was...
Where was that? I've never seen that.
It was in the London. It was in the London Film Festival,
right?
And
so it's not been shown on the BBC or anything.
I don't think so. I'm trying to restore it now, and I've lost the first reel. If you can imagine it.
Oh wow!
You know, I restored the table.
Yeah, that looks brilliant.
Or rather, my son did.
Yeah, well, he's done a good job. So if we go out on one question, so if you recommend a film that someone might not know to someone listening, to the people listening.
Film I'd recommend?
Yeah.
Okay, let me have a think. Oh, shit, that's a tough...
What was the first movie you owned?
Oh, hell, Jesus. Oh.
I can tell you the first DVD I owned, which was Jason and the Argonauts.
That's funny. I used to record endless stuff on the Z Channel. There was a thing in LA.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Z Channel. That was marvellous. Marvellous.
It's a great documentary about that.
Oh, it's terrific.
Z Channel.
Yeah, there was something weird about somebody committing suicide or something, wasn't there? Some weird death.
Yeah, I can't remember, but it's a really good documentary about this guy who got obsessed with film. It's like putting these films out and how it grew and grew up.
Marvellous, marvellous. And then have a season of Louis Malle, a season of... I mean, that'd be a good movie. Au revoir les enfants. That's a fucking great movie to watch.
Okay.
There's a movie that I love by a guy called Amalric, which I think is terrific.
What's that called?
It's called La Chambre Bleue, the blue room. And right. Marvellous. He's in it and he directed it. And it's just...
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, that's terrific. It's a story of, you know, passion and jealousy and murder. It's terrific. And it's...
Excellent.
Yeah, it's great. It's all shades of grey.
Excellent. That's brilliant. Can't thank you enough, Adrian. That's been absolutely brilliant. I've loved doing that.
All right, great. I'm thrilled. Speak soon. Well done.
Lovely. Thanks, Adrian. All the best.
Bye, sweetheart. Bye-bye, Donna.